When evening had come, he sat down with the 12. Now as they were eating, he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and each of them began to say to him, "Lord, is it I?" He answered and said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born." And then Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, "Rabbi, is it I?" He said to him, "You have said it." And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Please pray with me. O Christ, as you encouraged your disciples here, we ask so too that you would encourage us now as your disciples. We ask these things in your name. Amen. You may be seated. I'm wondering if this is a timeless reality among our just growing up children. I wonder if your parents, if you're ever getting ready for a sports game or an English test, if they say things to you like, "Well, before you head off for your test today or before you go into the next room to take your test today, it's important that you get a good breakfast." Has anybody heard anything like that before? I don't know if that's old-fashioned or what. I heard that about 1,000 times growing up, that somehow breakfast is going to help me with my test. And we'd hear the same thing, and children, I wonder if you heard the same thing, is that if you have something important to do the next day, that it's really important that you get your sleep. What do you think your parents are concerned about when they say you need to get a hearty breakfast, most important meal of the day, or that you need to get good sleep? Well, they always have something in mind that you're getting ready to face. And you know what you need when you're going to face it? Strength. You need strength. Mental strength, physical strength. We all need strength. And that's not just true for children. It's true for adults. We all know that. And it's not just true for physical or strength or mental acumen. It is especially true that our faith would have strength. And I'm wondering, just this, as we're here this evening and we're thinking about the death of Christ, we see him here with his disciples. We know Good Friday is tomorrow. I'm wondering if some of you are saying, maybe just to yourselves, "Boy, could I use some strength?" This passage addresses that. Jesus has been concerned about the strength of his disciples for a long time. Especially in the Gospel of Matthew here, we, in the triumphal entry, saw that he set up a scene after showing his divine omniscience and not only knowing that there was a donkey and a foal in a location, but also commanding it and claiming the rights of a king. We see that he's setting the whole thing up not to convince himself that he's the king, not to help himself, but to help his disciples. We see it, if you go back even further, that he is always trying to help his disciples along. And they're going to need some help, because after he entered into that city where we left off on Sunday, boy, did he provoke the leadership. Up to that point, he had been keeping his ministry largely a secret. He wouldn't let people talk about it. He wouldn't even let the demons say who he was. He would silence them. But when he entered into that city, he flipped over money changers' tables. He cursed the fig tree. He contradicted the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And by the time we get to chapter 26, what we find is that those leaders, those religious leaders who were over the governance of that temple, they have officially plotted to kill him. And Jesus knows it. He knows not only where donkeys are, he knows the thoughts and the intentions of men's hearts. And he knew that they were plotting to kill him. And that was why he was so impressed when the expensive oil was used on him to anoint him for burial. He saw someone who the Lord had blessed with the knowledge that, yeah, the time has come. My hour is here. I have provoked, and not only will I need strength, and I will have it as the Lord, but I will also need to continue to give my disciples strength. And that's where we land ourselves now, as we're watching Christ seeking in this moment of the Passover and the celebration of it to give his disciples strength. He's going to use this time in the dimness of the light, reclining around the table, special quality time with just them, to make sure that they have strength. In fact, we could say that this whole thing may be summarized this way, that is, that the Lord strengthens his disciples. And he's going to do it in two ways in this passage, by the knowledge of his betrayal and by instituting his supper. And that's the same way that he wants to strengthen you tonight. He wants to consider his betrayal with you. And he wants you to think about his supper and what it means. And so let's begin by just looking at the Lord's betrayal, and then we'll look at the Lord's supper. I know that you can't see unless you decided to bring a book light, your passage, or maybe you can. But I'll just try to read these things aloud so that you know exactly what I'm referring to here. We begin the whole passage in verse 20 with the Lord's betrayal. And here Jesus is going to discuss his betrayal with his disciples. It says, when evening had come, he sat down with the 12. And now as they were eating, he said, assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. And they were exceedingly sorrowful. And each of them began to say to him, Lord, is it I? And he answered, it's the one who has dipped his hand in the dish with me. He's the one that betrays me. And this has been written about me. And woe to that person who does the betrayal. It would be better if they weren't born. This is the full discussion. He tells them about the betrayal. They respond, they're aghast that this is going to happen. I mean, they've stuck with him all along. They were the ones that put their clothes on the donkey. And perhaps some of them wanted to get in on the palm branches and throw them under his feet too, yelling that Jesus is king instead of Jehu is king, singing the Hallel Psalms to him, announcing him as the Messiah, having all of this intimate instruction as he taught them about the fig tree. And they're aghast, and they're sorrowful. He's been telling them since early on that he was going to be betrayed. But now they're not only sorrowful, but they're wondering, well, who is it going to be? Now that we found out it's going to be one of us. Is it me? Am I the one that's going to do that? And he answers and he says, now this dinner is set up to where it's, this is a really degrades the sermon in a sense, but if you could picture, actually, I won't degrade it. Just picture olive oil in the center of the table with herbs. And you have fresh bread and you dip it in. And you eat your bread. All of them are doing that. And he said, as the one has dipped their bread in the dish with me this night. And they still don't know who it is because everybody's been dipping their bread in the dish that night. So he hasn't given it away. But he warns that whoever it is, that it would have been better for them not to be born. Now that's the betrayal as he tells it. And you've got to wonder why would God think that it was so important to record this and to inscripturate it for us? That is to say, to have it written down and preserved for all generations. Is he just trying to maintain a history book so that we would know all of the facts and that they had bread and that there was oil on the table and that they did this on a certain night? Certainly, the Lord wanted us to remember the history. But if we looked at the other Gospels, it's interesting what the other writers of the Gospels say about this very moment and the Lord's purpose in bringing up his betrayal. If you were to, on your own time, turn to the Gospel of John, chapter 13, verse 19, John, thinking of this same moment, he says this, this is Jesus speaking, and he records them. He says, "I do not speak concerning all of you. I know whom I have chosen. But that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. Now I tell you," listen to Jesus' purpose in telling us about his betrayal. "Now I tell you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe that I am he." Do you see how he's taking care of his disciples there? Do you see how he's seeking to strengthen them as they head off into war? In John 13:19, we're given that picture that he's orienting his disciples to make sure that he understands, that they understand exactly what's going on here. And he turns them then to Psalm 41, verse 9, which we've already read within the bulletin. And just as we saw within the triumphal entry, where Jesus had pulled Zechariah 9:9, and I think Isaiah chapter 62, and Genesis chapter 45, I believe it was, pulling all of these different scriptures together and fulfilling all of these various prophecies, that they might know that I am he. So too is he doing that here with them, reassuring them, making sure that they have the right narrative. Can you imagine, you know, in our culture, how many different narratives are going on at any one time about any one event? You know how many narratives the Sadducees and the Pharisees would spin about who Jesus is? We could go back earlier in Matthew and see in chapter 16 that Jesus actually asked them at one point, "Who do you say that I am?" And then Peter says, "Well, some say you're this, some say you're that, some say you're this other thing." There's all kinds of narratives going on about Christ. Well, here he's making sure, by way of Psalm 41, verse 9, as clarified from John chapter 13, verse 19, he's making sure that they know, "I am he. I am the Messiah." And I wonder if you were sitting there with them that night, I bet you it would be about, the lighting would be about like this. And you realize if Psalm 41:9 popped to your head and you said, "It's him." I wonder in what way it would strengthen you beyond just being prepared for a Bible quiz. I wonder in what way that would make you strong in your faith. One of the first things I think that you would have to do, one of the first ways in which you would be strengthened, I believe, would be that you would realize that I'm not dealing with a mere human being here. Who could do these things but God himself? They already had some sense of that because of the pictures of the Son of Man and Daniel defying what it means to be a man. It must also be divine. And here, that's starting to perhaps dawn on them just a little bit more. And that would dawn on you if you were sitting there. And you'd be strengthened thinking, well, if God is on our side, then who could be against us? And I wonder if you would also be comforted by the fact, not only do I realize that he's God, but this is God who's already foreknowing all things that come to pass, even the one who is going to betray him. And if he knows all of those things, how is it that we could ever actually lose. It reminded me of when I had been studying the Shorter Catechism, question number 11, when it says, what are God's works of providence? God's works of providence are His most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing all His creatures and all their actions. And boy, does that scene illustrate Jesus Christ as the God-man, powerfully preserving and governing the entire plan of salvation. Judas isn't getting one over on him. Jesus knows exactly who will betray him. And boy, could that strengthen us. No surprises for him. And I'm sure that it strengthened the disciples of that time. Well, that's just the betrayal of Christ and some of the ways in which that could strengthen his disciples and it would strengthen us. I wonder if there's some things in your life right now that are overwhelming and overcoming you. And I wonder if part of the reason why you feel that way is because you think that this is a surprise and that God wasn't aware that this was going to happen or that something is outside of his control and his governance. Well, may this give you strength, seeing here in this single example of Christ knowing his betrayer, that Christ knows all things that happen in your life, and all things in your life are under his government. And as his followers and as his children, he will move all of those things to your good and to his glory, even those who betray you. We also have the Lord's Supper here. Not just the betrayal, but we're to be strengthened by the Lord's Supper. And this picks up in verse number 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it. And I'll go on with that in just a moment. But the first thing I want you to remember is just the setting here, which was given to us in verse number 20. When evening had come. The reason why it's evening is because they're celebrating the Passover in the traditional manner, and you had to wait until the evening to enter into this. And so now, picture them all reclining around the table with low light. They had done this their whole lives. It's a part of the Passover festival. This isn't a special dinner outside of the Passover. This is incorporated into the Passover itself. They're all reclining. They're having the typical Passover meal there in the evening. And Jesus decides to take advantage of the moment and reconstitutes the meal and institutes his supper because, boy, are things going to change. He says in 26, and as they were eating during this Passover meal, Jesus took bread, he blessed it, and he broke it, and he gave it out to the disciples, and he said, take, eat, this is my body. And then he took the cup and he gave thanks and he gave it to them and he said, drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Do you see this, how the setting makes a difference here? They already have items on the table that have significance. And he's adding his items and then telling them the significance of them. I wonder if any of you have ever had the opportunity to attend or at least watch a YouTube video about a Passover meal. It's taken from Exodus 12, where the Israelites were each year to commemorate their Exodus from Egypt. And the Passover lamb and the lentils, I think we've all heard that story. They were to have unleavened bread because they were supposed to leave the city quickly. They were to have the Passover lamb. They were to as they slaughtered the lambs, they were to catch the blood in basins and then dip hyssop and then to write on the lentils blood. And all of those that had the blood of the lamb on their door, death would pass over. And that went on, and it was more than just death passing over. They were delivered from the house of bondage. And when they were having that meal, and they would recall for future generations all that the Lord had done in his redemption and salvation of Israel, there would be questions and answers at the table, like a kind of catechism. They would say, "What is the meaning of the bitter herbs?" And he would answer, "What is the meaning of this special dish that we've made?" "Well, that's to recall that we were in slavery, and it looks like cement and all of the mortar we had to make and all the bricks until we were made free by the Lord." "And what does the lamb and the blood?" And there would be this question and this answer and dialogue that would go on at the table. Today, there's traditionally, among the Jewish communities, there's four main questions, and then they go from there. I want you to imagine the signs that Jesus Christ is instituting in that same kind of context and in that same kind of setting. We see that he gives us the bread. There are actions that go along with the bread, and there's wine, and there's actions that go along with the wine. The bread is in verse 26, and the wine in 27 through 29. And I just want you to imagine that there's a dialogue that's taking place there. Imagine somebody reclining with you in the dim light. Let's say it's Bob over here on the left. And he says, "What is the meaning of the bread? Wait, what? What is the meaning of the bread?" And then Jesus would answer, "Well, this is my body." And then perhaps someone over here, maybe it's Sarah. "And why did you break the bread?" "Because my body will be broken in death." "And why is it that I eat the bread that's broken?" "Well, because my death is for you. And it will give you life." "Well, in what way is that going to give me life? Are you telling me that it will give me life in the sense of this is a moral lesson and I should be someone who's devoted to God just as you would be devoted to God unto death?" "Well, you should be devoted to God unto death, but no, this is much more what I'm talking about here. There's much more going on with my life and my death. And these are signifying what the much more is." "Well, what is the much more?" "Well, do you remember Isaiah chapter 53? Can you imagine the dialogue? And then imagine Jesus reading Isaiah 53 to everybody at the table. Reading his biography. "But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and it was by his stripes that we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter. And as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." Can you imagine hearing that from Christ right there at the table? And it dawning on you the significance of what the life and the death of Jesus Christ will be. And that he's trying to help you and strengthen you by way of the institution of his supper. So that you could remember that as often as you observe the supper. And then you would move on to the wine. "What is the meaning of the wine?" He would say, "It signifies my blood." Instead of the blood of the lamb that we just talked about with the Passover, with the lentils and the hyssop, or even the blood that Moses used in order to his covenant, the Mosaic covenant and the hyssop in that case. "Well, why do we need new blood? Why can't we just keep using the old blood?" "Well, the blood of bulls and goats. was but a shadow of what I'm accomplishing. And this is a new Exodus. This is a new covenant. Those were but shadows of me and the redemption which I would accomplish. If your body is broken and your blood is spilled, how is it that you tell us that you will drink wine with us in the future? How will you drink wine with us if you're dead? And that's why I think this is significant that on verse number 30 it says, and then they sang a hymn. Now these hymns are going to be usually from Psalm 113 to 118. And all of them are praising God. But listen to this one. And I just wonder, this is speculation, but I just wonder if this is the one that he picked to sort of answer that. It says this in Psalm 116 verses 8 through 9. For you, he's speaking to the Father, for you have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, and my feet from falling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living. He already knows the whole plan that the Father and he have and where this is going to end. And it will end in his resurrection. Though he be but on Monday, Thursday, he already has Easter in mind. Now, can you imagine being those disciples having grown up in the Jewish synagogue, having celebrated the Passover the same way every single year with your aunts and your uncles and your family? And this is what the lamb means, and this is what the blood means, and this is what the bitter herb means, and this is what this means, and this means. And then Jesus comes along, and he takes those things off of the table, because they are now an old redemption that still must be remembered to the glory of God, but there's something new that has come, and he says, this is the bread and this is the wine. Is it possible for them to go back and just celebrate the old Passover? It's not. Everything is going to change for them. Everything will change for them. They'll have to reread Zechariah 9:9, won't they? When he got on the donkey. And they'd have to reread all of those other verses that I had mentioned, including Isaiah 53. And now it's all going to be different. The thing that would remain meaningful for them and for all of the disciples from that point forward will be remembering him and the significance of his death by way of the bread and of the wine. That will be the Exodus that is remembered. That will be the redemption that is celebrated. And when they would really get a hold of it, they would be strengthened as disciples. If you just go back to thinking about God redeeming his people, and we're invited to go back to the Exodus, do you remember when Pharaoh finally gives up? He releases all of the people. He gives them belongings for them to exit. And then they're all gathered right in front of the sea. And then Pharaoh changes his mind. And do you know what that does? It means you have a sea on one side of you. And you have Pharaoh and his army on the other side. And though that is not the redemption or the Exodus that we're celebrating any longer with the Lord's Supper, the situation is the same for us, and the importance of the remembrance of our redemption is analogous also. How many of you have something that feels like Pharaoh's army that you're up against on the left side and a sea on the right? What are the things that you are up against? What are the things from which you need deliverance? Every time I speak with each of you, and I take the opportunity to speak to myself, we all need deliverance from our sins. And the longer I'm here on earth, the more people I see die. And boy, do we need deliverance from death. If that's not an army and a sea, I don't know what else is. But this is the interesting thing, is that the army never got to the Israelites because God just split the sea. Just like he splits the grave and resurrects us. Though these situations seem impossible for us, they're not impossible for him. And we're to remember all of these things when we take the bread and we take the wine. We're to remember not just that he knew of his betrayal, but that he knew of how he would die and what it would accomplish, and that he would be raised from the dead. He's singing the Hallel Psalms that say that he would be, and that this is all a part of his powerful and wise governance. It is part of his plan for you to be between the soldiers and the sea. And he wants you to turn to him and in faith trust that he will save you, that which is impossible for you is not impossible for him. What could keep you from accomplishing his salvation? If God is for you, who could be against you? These are all of the ways, well really, these are some of the ways in which, if we reflect on what Christ is doing here, we would be strengthened. We would be strengthened knowing that even if people kill us, God's just going to raise us up again. That's the exodus that Christ is talking about. And that's the kind of confidence that we can have. And it is my prayer that during this season, you would be strengthened just as his disciples were in this passage, and that we would be discipled by we would be strengthened as his disciples by the knowledge of his betrayal and him instituting his supper. Let us pray.